Hey there, I'm Brooke Thomas. As you can see, not John Iadarola. This is still the damage report, but John's out this morning, and so I'm filling in with you. And although John is not here, it is still JR Wednesdays.
These things don't change.
No, they
What's
can't change.
What's going on, you know? Brooke?
Hey.
This is, what do we call this, cranberry?
Maroon wine?
Oh, maroon wine. See,
it's a wine color. Yeah.
I knew there was going to be a color that's not a color and like a thing, because that's usually if it's.
But it's a color of the best thing.
that works. But then also, when there's wine color, what about the white wine? Is that a color as well? If I'm wearing gold, is that considered wine?
First of all, it's kind of clear. It's like a yellowy clear.
Yeah, it's kind of pee.
It's see-through. I think you're doing too much, okay?
But it is, you know, JR Wednesday, thank you. My coffee's getting cold. I wish I had, you know, little known facts. Let's go ahead and tell you.
Okay.
Brooke Thomas has a coffee warmer.
But you made fun of me when I brought it here, and you use it more than I do. Do you remember that you made fun of me?
This was my story.
I have this little coffee mug warmer, and JR loves it.
I didn't ask for an extension of the story. I just asked to tell mine.
All right.
This is JR Wednesday.
All right, it is JR Wednesday. Okay, we've got a lot going on today.
Yeah.
With Mueller, of course. We've got a couple great interviews. David Dennis Jr. is coming back, and we always love when we have him. We are talking about a school district out of Pennsylvania that did something that horrified a lot of people, and then they kind of doubled down and did something else that a lot of people wish they didn't do. And a scary story out of Texas involving Border Patrol and an 18-year-old American held in custody for far too long. All right, so let's get to it.
The Russian government's effort to interfere in our election is among the most serious. And as I said on May 29th, this deserves the attention of every American.
There he is, former special counsel Robert Mueller testifying before the House Judiciary Committee. That's the end of his opening statement this morning. So, you know, why is he there? What is he testifying about? Well, essentially, Democrats are there digging into his report, and Republicans are there grilling him and digging into his investigation. So pretty soon into his testimony, we got Mueller to confirm that Trump is not telling the truth when he repeatedly says that the Mueller report totally clears him. Take a look.
So the report did not conclude that he did not commit obstruction of justice. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what about total exoneration? Did you actually totally exonerate the president?
No.
Now, in fact, your report expressly states that it does not exonerate the president.
It does.
Right. Right.
I'm not sure how many more ways it can be said.
Very clear. Again,
I came into this skeptical because you know there was the even before Robert Mueller said he's going to follow what the Department of Justice guidelines are saying to not say anything, not even say what was in the report or just keep it to what was already been said, keep it to our truncated report that excluded all the things that are damning in the report. So even outside of that, I was like, yeah, I'm tired of the buildup, and I'm tired of the expectations that Robert Mueller is going to come with these bombs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was right off the top. And the worst part is that's going to be considered a bomb. Oh my God, he just blew up the president's whole lie. Everyone's been blowing up the president's whole lie except for the president, Sean Hannity,
and
every other Republican that's trying to back him up. So I guess it did take us to hear it this way. So I'm willing to admit I was wrong, because that one moment is going to be powerful from now on out on this whole thing, because apparently saying it wasn't working.
There's another moment that for me was even more powerful, and I want to get to that. But I also want to say that also in that back and forth with Nadler, Mueller confirmed Trump refused a request to be interviewed by his team, although he tried for more than a year and also advised the president's lawyer the interview with Trump is vital to this investigation. Something that I saw from a lot of people online, this was a common reaction. They were saying that Republicans there, Republican members of Congress, were acting as if they were Trump's defense attorneys.
Absolutely.
In their questionings, in their opening statement, what they were saying. And at least in one instance, it backfired. I want you to take a look at Republican Representative Ken Buck from Colorado. He kind of begins grilling Mueller and implying as if during his investigation, he was fishing.
The OLC opinion, Office of Legal Counsel, indicates that we cannot indict a sitting president. So one of the tools that a prosecutor would use is not there.
Okay, but let me just stop. You made the decision on the Russian interference. You couldn't have indicted the president on that, and you made the decision on that. But when it came to obstruction, you threw a bunch of stuff up against the wall to see what would stick. Well, and that is fundamentally unfair.
I would not agree to that characterization at all.
You know, he's on a roll, right? You threw a bunch of things up against the wall, and wait until you see how this ends.
Okay, but the could you charge the president with a crime after he left office?
Yes.
You believe that he committed, you could charge the president of the United States with obstruction of justice after he left office?
Yes.
I tell you, that is not at all, you can tell that's not the response he thought he was getting.
It's weird. Okay, you know how they always say, and a lot of these guys are attorneys, and they this was specifically happening when Kamala Harris was grilling folks on different, I forget which hearing it was, but I think it was actually a Barr, she had him tied up in knots. They said a good attorney never asks a question they don't know the answer to.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the saying. I'm not.
That's good. Yeah.
Right.
I feel like
I've heard that. We'll have to consult with Adrian about that. But so he's asking the questions. This a representative is asking these questions. You're supposed to know where this is going. Of course, you should know that obstruction of justice charges would happen to anyone else. You don't have to be deep into the facts to realize that. It's been said over and over again. Reason why they couldn't charge him is because he's the president. How did you not read that part? I didn't read the entire Mueller report, and I know that part. It's been said over and over again. You have to ignore the facts and be so deep into your own fanfare that in order to come to a hearing like that and think you have I got him. In reality, you've just shot yourself in the foot. How do you come in like that?
Right.
How do your aides let you come in like that?
Right. How, and you could tell he felt like he was on a roll though. You could tell, like by the way, you know, he says, you know, you're just throwing stuff up against the wall and to see what stuck. And you know, Mueller's like, well, no, very calm. I don't agree with that characterization. Okay, well, what about this? So can they, yes.
Yes, actually.
Actually, that can.
And by the way, even if you were listening to the previous interaction, he said because of the determination about a sitting president, we can't charge. He just said it again.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're listening to the flow of the conversation, you'd go, so that means if he's not a sitting president, then 2 + 2 = 4. And then 4 means that if he wasn't a sitting president, we would charge him. So why would you ask that question?
Why would you ask that question?
He just told you that 2 + 2 = 4, and you go, hey, but what about 3 + 1? It's like, that also equals 4.
That's 4.
Jesus.
Yeah, do you want to talk Don McGahn? So, former White House Don McGahn. So, obviously, a huge part of this investigation, a huge part of the Mueller report. You may remember that the president was seemingly angry at Don McGahn after it came out that Don McGahn's, I guess his answers, his interview was a massive part of the Mueller report, and the president wasn't happy with that. So today, Mueller confirmed Trump ordered former White House counsel Don McGahn to lie. Take a look at this.
And to be clear, the president is asking his White House counsel, Don McGahn, to create a record that McGahn believed to be untrue while you were in the midst of investigating the president for obstruction of justice, correct?
Generally correct.
And Mr. McGahn was an important witness in that investigation, wasn't he?
I'd have to say yes.
I have to say yes.
But it's like just even in that. So the president ordered, there's a lot of extra words, but the president ordered him to do something that he knew was a lie, that everyone knew was a lie. Ooh, generally correct. That's massive. The only problem with all of this is that we knew all of this.
Right. And again, maybe that's what can come from this, is actually the rest of the general public, and I don't expect any sitting Republicans to actually get this, because actually many of them do.
Mm-hmm.
But or the ones, any of them to publicly get that this is what has been said over and over again. So no matter how many times you have Trump and his surrogates say no collusion, no obstruction of justice, it's been proven over and over again. The Mueller report says so. The Mueller report says so. They said it over and over again.
Right.
So where people, because they know the laziness of Americans, will not read it or won't listen to folks who have read it. And I get it. It's 1,000 pages, right? I don't expect everyone to read it.
Right.
Right.
Sure.
I don't. But if someone who has read it, that's the point of people who do that job. You listen to what they've said come out of it. Not the guy who's the focus of the report, because what do you think he's going to say?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. So also, the other part the Republicans did throughout this, I was listening and watching most of the morning. Many of the things the Republicans were doing through this was after, since they can't dispute the facts, which when they tried to, it ended up backfiring on them. Then it goes to the character assassination of Mueller himself. You were up for the, which job was he up for? They said he interviewed for a job with the president.
Oh, right, yeah, which wasn't
you
true.
You had surrogates that were Democrats, right? And every time they expected to be this, oh yeah, I'm sorry, you got me. And it ended up being frustrating because he said, at one point, I think it was, he said, I don't analyze any of the backgrounds of people who work for me. I don't ask, are you Republican or Democrat? You know why? Because that's what he's supposed to do.
Right.
And we also know that there was many Republicans that worked for him. There's Democrats that worked for him because he said, I need people that are going to do the job. This is not a partisan situation.
Right.
So they went into it expecting all this. Again, not knowing the answer. How? I don't think you knew if you go in and say, well, aren't you corrupt? Didn't you hire Democrats because you were against President Trump? He's going to say, no.
No. A lot of just simple yes or no answers that are not going their way. Before we go to break, I want your thoughts on, you know, what do you think is going to come from any of this? All of this? Because just to note, Mueller is also testifying before the House Intelligence Committee also today. And that may have already happened. It hadn't happened.
Yeah, it's
it was scheduled to happen about an hour ago, but it was running late.
It all depends. I mean, at least from the first half of the day, this. You're going to have this at least get repeated over and over in news cycles now. We're going to have to see what the spin that comes through from the right-wing media does, because that's where the focus of many people that are going to circle the wagons to go to. So people were looking at this, if they're looking at it, which many of them won't be. They'll look, what are my conservative and Republican friends saying about this? What are my leaders going to tell me my escape route is from this? That's where we're going to have the difference. And whatever people in the middle, I'm not sure what the people in the middle would normally think, that's the difference. Folks that are sycophants, we can't deal with anymore. At least as far as convincing them.
Yeah.
So it's all a matter of the people who actually have an open mind to see what the real truth is.
All right, well, we'll see what happens. We're coming back. We're going to have David Dinnis Jr. on the show. We're going to talk more about Mueller, more about Trump. Stay with us.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Hey there, welcome back to The Damage Report. I'm Brooke Thomas, sitting in with J.R. Jackson. We are here together on J.R. Wednesdays, filling in for John Iadarola. Got a great interview coming up for you. I always love having David Dinnis Jr. on, senior culture editor of Interactive One, and just all around greatness, I think.
I think so.
David's super dad today, is that right?
Yeah, I got the kids. They're upstairs. They're watching some sort of Netflix show. I hope it's age appropriate, but don't come to my face. I'll find out when this is over what's going on.
You have to walk in slowly and quietly. I have one, my 7-year-old. You just kind of sneak in and then just look at the look on his face. Don't ask him anything because you're not going to get a right answer. Just look at him, and that's when you get your answer.
Yeah, that's the plan. Do a button the door, do a little slow rolling, and see what's going on.
That's good stuff. All right, let's get right into it. We just spent the last block talking about the Mueller testimony. What were your thoughts so far?
I thought it was sort of disappointing for the most part. I feel like Mueller you know, he skipped about 100 questions. He has, through this whole process, sort of refused to plant his flag on any sort of definitive answers coming out of this. And there's a lot of, you know, escaping what the real issue is, and that the president needs to be needs to go under the impeachment process. I mean, there's really no way around it. And he Mueller has the information. He has the facts. He's presented it. But he's fallen short of making that recommendation. I understand that he likes to follow the rule of law, and he values the political process over more than the actual human beings whose lives are at stake. But that's sort of the central issue here, is that we have a lot of people who want to play politics and want to play rules and want to play the game and chess and checkers, when there are actual human beings in cages right now who need to be freed. And that's the central issue. And it seems like we have a lack of people in DC who want to actually change that.
So David, so in going into this, I guess because of the conclusion you just came to there, two parts. What was your expectations coming into this? And also, even after what was said, because there were some damning things that did come out, after what was said, do you think it's impossible for us to get to that point anyway? Like, you can take the information he did say is as, I guess, as minor as he was putting it, and still get to that expectation, because I didn't expect much from this in the first place.
Yeah, I didn't expect much either. You know, I learned in 2016 not to put that much faith in the larger American populace, the political process, to really save this country from itself. Especially when the people who are feeling the bigger effects from it are the marginalized folks among us. So we have, you know, a Congress that is, for the most part, full of people who are not feeling the direct effects of what Trump is doing. So, you know, Mueller is going to say, you know, some of the things that we already could have gleaned from the report. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the big stories coming out of this is him saying that if Trump were not president, that he would probably face charges. But at the same time, I mean, what's really going to happen as a result? I mean, are we really looking at a political system that over the last 2 years has really failed to do anything in terms of punishing this man for the crimes he's been, you know, he's committed? You know, what's really going to happen? So like you, I had pretty low faith in everything that happened this morning.
So do you think nothing can come of it because of what we've gotten? Do you think they can't get to that point of holding him accountable?
I really find it hard. I mean, you know, on the Democrat side, you have Pelosi, who is really sort of hesitant to come up with impeachment. It seems like there's a few people who are on that boat who are called radicals. I'm really having a hard time finding anything that will lead to Trump not fulfilling his term as president. And, you know, I really feel like November 2020 is really the earliest that we should expect him to leave the White House. And even then, you know, my takeaway from Mueller saying that if Trump were not in office, he could face charges, that seems to lean itself to Trump tightening his grip on the presidency. And I'm not sure that we are looking at a true democratic exchange of power in November 2020.
All right, David, let's talk about Trump's racist outburst last week, the latest, what a lot of us are willing to acknowledge, the latest. Mm-hmm. But you had a lot of people who consider themselves well-meaning say, you know, this came out of nowhere. They were so shocked. This is the worst it's ever been. And you've said something that, you know, black reporters, black people have been warning you about Trump.
Yeah, so when Trump made the comments last week about these women needing to go back to their country, mm-hmm, if they didn't like America, I really did not blink. I mean, this is the Donald Trump that we have seen for 30 years. This is a man who put out ads asking that, you know, five innocent black kids be lynched. This is somebody who, you know, had racist practices in terms of who he would let into his properties. This is somebody who began his political career and run for president by calling Mexicans rapists. This is somebody who was called African countries S-holes. I mean, this is somebody who refused to condemn white supremacists, who said they're bad people on both sides. This is just was basically par for the course for the racism that he has had for his whole life and definitely as president. So I did not find it that surprising. I didn't find it to be any more outrageous than anything else he said. And I find it interesting that there is suddenly an ability to call him racist when he has been racist this entire time.
And so speaking of par for the course, I think one could say it's not only par for the course for Trump, but par for the course for the conservative movement. Because take a look at this tweet, okay? It is from, and like, save your groans, everybody out there, the senior editor of the National Review, I know. But he tweeted this. He said, I'm going to write a tweet that's going to tick a lot of people off. Reagan conservatives like me have been called racist falsely and maliciously all of our lives. So to many Americans, every charge of racism, and no matter how legitimate, rings hollow. Good job, wolf criers. So that feels dishonest and still at a space of not willing to acknowledge what I think Adam Serwer puts it as the conservative movement's general trajectory. That, I'm talking policies, rhetoric, we can name countless examples over the years, long before Trump, that did kind of open the door to what we have now, which is just out in the open.
Yeah, so there is a definite line from the conservative policy over the last few decades to Donald Trump. You know, even the never Trumpers have led the way to Trump. I mean, John McCain, for instance, is the patron saint of never Trumpers. But, you know, there would be no Donald Trump if John McCain had not, you know, walked around with, you know, with his running mate in 2008, Sarah Palin. And allowed her to sort of speak that nasty rhetoric about Obama that sort of paved the way for the Tea Party members, which paved the way for Trump. I mean, this is sort of a direct line. This is not a surprise. This is not a blip on the radar. This is a natural progression that got us to Donald Trump. Every person who has voted for gerrymandering, every person who has, you know, voted for mandatory minimums, everybody who is along this conservative line that we see every day, this is a Trump party. This is not an anomalous political event in America. This is part of the line of American history.
So, David, under the wing on this, I mean, because we talk about people like Jay Nordlinger, who was talking about the losing the bite of racism and talking about the word itself. But then there's the other part of it where the media goes into it. I mean, you're involved in it, we are as well. But I think a lot of folks in general don't understand the way that media has to approach these things. So the way that they use the word, I noticed CNN has been blatantly saying it. And I was like, oh, okay, so they're not scared anymore. Can you go into maybe the, I guess, reading the temperature that a lot of media figures have to go into in worrying about losing some viewers and readers because of using the word? Is that something that is still so widespread, or is that starting to lose its worry?
Yeah, I think what has been missing from the media is a clear, defined sort of style book within their own writing about what constitutes racism, what constitutes a racist. Like, it has been sort of decided that that is a subjective term, that that is a form of opining that is that falls in op-eds and not necessarily in directly reported stories. But the fact is, we have a president who is sort of shifting the paradigm, and we need to have within each newsroom, a definition of what is racism. What is racism? What can we call racism in our headlines? You know, it's interesting to me that you can say telling people to go back to their country is racist, but him saying that African countries are assholes is not. So that sort of murky ground needs to, you know, we need to get rid of that. And so that is something that newsrooms are struggling with. And one of the reasons newsrooms are struggling with this is because they don't have enough black people in there telling them, you know, sort of helping them and guiding them about what these words mean.
Absolutely.
There's so much I wanted to talk to you about. We are like, we both have so many questions. Me and JR here. I love talking to you, David. David Dennis Jr., senior culture editor of Interactive One. Go up there, make sure the kids aren't watching anything bad.
Gotcha.
Thanks again. Thanks for being here. David is great. All right. We will be right back with lots more. Lots more. Stay with us. Hey there, welcome back. Pennsylvania School District has actually turned down a local businessman's offer to pay off student lunch debts, okay? And the reason this has a lot of people upset is because this same district actually recently, they made a lot of people angry after threatening parents over unpaid lunches. Specifically, we're talking about Wyoming Valley West School District, and it's kind of confusing to people who don't know how Pennsylvania operates, but that's an area in Pennsylvania called Wyoming Valley. And so this school district, they actually sent this letter. I want you to see it to parents. And in this letter, they say that parents, their kids could be recommended to be put in foster care if they don't pay off school lunch deaths. And even just that, before I even get to the rest of it, you're a parent. This is horrifying.
This is the thing. There's many ways that schools approach parents, and a lot of times it's in a, hey, we need you type of way, even when it's something like this. So this was a bit startling, and it makes me wonder what their general interactions are with parents and certain kids already, because this was a, for people who maybe are listening or aren't watching, that letter had spaces in it open, so it's like a formatted letter to where you have to fill in the child's name, mm-hmm. then fill in the amount that they owe, and then say, they've been... What is it? Is it been purchasing breakfast and or lunch at this school? So
this is cool.
It's across the board and gets sent out just in general for this purpose of getting them to pay for whatever debts that there are on the school lunch. So this wasn't like a rogue intern. I like to use that term because whenever someone's tweets something, they're rogue intern. This wasn't just some low level person that said, hey, let me put together a letter and start threatening parents. This was from the top.
Absolutely. And the district's lawyer actually defended the letter, saying that they hope that this would get parents' attention. But the thing is, and the problem here is that we're talking about, first of all, school lunches are generally not great. It's not something you would willingly go out and pay for. Yeah. Also, generally in these situations, we're talking about people who are poor, people who can't afford it. And I think that what we see repeatedly in a lot of these situations is that there's a lack of compassion. Obviously, the district needs to recoup money. Mm-hmm. Obviously, school districts need money. They need to pay for these lunches, but kids need to eat. All kids deserve to eat. And if a parent can't afford to pay for their kid's lunch, the idea of threatening them to over a $2 lunch, horrifying. Or, we've got kids that don't get to eat in other districts, kids that are embarrassed in other districts. This is horrible.
I went through the free lunch program as a kid.
Me too.
I remember what it was like.
Yeah.
And so then the brown paper bag lunches were like, oh, I envy that.
Yeah. And people who got like chicken strips or like juice or something like that, for sure. Yeah.
So those things, even when the parents do maybe go through the process of making sure that they're on the program, it's still not. There's still this hierarchy of which kids are on this and not. And that's just among kids. So I can understand when the 10-year-old is going over and making fun of the fact the kid punched the card or checked the box instead of paying the $1.95 for lunch. That's kids. And we're gonna have to go ahead and fix that as they get older, make sure they understand the processes of life and society. But when you have the entire school district doing this, it's like, are they being run by children?
Right.
This is the cruelty that comes to another level.
Yeah, and so Todd Carmichael, the CEO of La Colombe Coffee Roaster, you guys have probably heard of La Colombe, he actually offered to pay off the more than $22,000 of debt for the students. And as I mentioned earlier, he got a no thanks. Here's what he wrote in an op-ed in the Wilkes-Barre Citizen's Voice about the response he got from the district. Okay, he said, on Monday, we talked to the school board president, Joseph Mazur, to determine the best way to transfer the funds in order to wipe the slate clean and restore dignity to the 1,000 families who received these threatening letters. Shockingly, Mr. Mazur turned us down. I can't explain or justify his actions. Let me be clear, we offered over $22,000 with no strings attached, and he said no. And then further following up saying, Mr. Mazur, I am offering to pay this debt in full. By saying no, you are not just shaming families who elected you, but you are placing this burden on Wyoming Valley West taxpayers, and that is completely unfair.
Okay, so I'm so glad he wrote it out this way and made sure that he knew the implications of what he was offering and then what the answer was. So a lot of times look for motivation behind whether or not someone really wants to pay the debt. Collectors call folks all the time.
Right.
And then so if they get their money, they get their money. They're like, hey, okay, cool, we got our money. Because that's the point, to get your money back. So then once, who cares where it came from? It's money. It's the same currency no matter whose bank account it came from.
Exactly.
So in this case, when the superintendent or the Joseph Mazur, the school board president, says, no, I don't want that money. I just want to threaten parents. So we see the motivations behind it. I want to threaten folks that I think are lesser than me. The degree to which people, this isn't just our country, around the world, but let's focus on our country since this is in Pennsylvania, want to make sure that they have this stamp of I'm better than you over 1,000 families is more important than actually doing your job.
Right.
Somehow this became personal for you to say, you know what? No, I want to illegally threaten parents and tell them their kid's going to be taken away over whatever debt is there versus getting the money back. So you're just going to turn down the donation, which actually is the money that you should have in your pocket already.
Right.
Your pride is that big. Your supremacy is that important to you.
The cruelty is the point. And just to make it clear, a rep from the county stepped in and made very clear that they in no way ever had taken a kid out of their home over unpaid school lunch debt, and they never will. We'll be right back with another great interview and another interesting but pretty horrifying story. Stay with us. Hey there, welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm Brooke Thomas, sitting in for John Iadarola today, here with J.R. Jackson. And our next guest is a writer and the host of the podcast Mass for Shut-Ins. And I want to get right into this interview. Ed Vermilla, thank you for joining us here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so after the crowd at a Trump rally chanted, send her back, as the president kind of paused to allow it after he had brought up Representative Ilhan Omar, you wrote a piece headlined, "This is going to get worse." Break that down for me.
Well, this is Trump's bread and butter, racism, xenophobia, basically mainstreaming white nationalism. Mm-hmm. And being as that we're in a year and a half out from the campaign or the actual election at this point, I just had a flash forward of what 2020 is going to look like if we're already at this point. You know, we all remember living through 2016, which was an unpleasant election to have to follow every day. Now we've gotten 3 years of getting used to Trump saying these outrageous and, you know, things that are intended to be shocking. And if this is how he and his base of supporters are behaving already, we can only imagine once they start to get into the, you know, the mode of the campaign, maybe if they even start feeling like they're falling behind or in danger of losing, they're just going to keep amping up this kind of rhetoric.
Ed, JR, once you were saying it's going to get much worse, did you, at least specifically from your point of view, did you see this getting much worse once you saw things like this? Was it Charlottesville? Was it their rapists and murderers when he came down the escalator? Because there's so many instances when you could say this is going to get much worse, and it did. Because, I mean, after rapists and cantaloupe calves that Steve King said, then we get the camps at the border. After S-hole countries, then we get send them back, go back where you came from. When was it that you saw it getting much worse? Because from the beginning, it started and it's gotten worse.
Well, 2016 was the point at which I suspected things were going to progressively get worse. Mm-hmm. As he gets bolder, as he gets more into the mode of playing to live crowds, which is something he really seems to feed off of. But you're absolutely right. This has been getting worse, in essence, for 3 years now. My motivation to write this piece was that as we get into the actual 2020 campaign, as he finally joins what the Democratic Party candidates are already doing, the sort of active campaigning mode, that the only way that you can continue to get a rise out of people is to continue to ramp up the rhetoric. And the farther we get into the campaign and the more he starts feeding off of live audiences, the more explicit these kinds of appeals to what's essentially European-style far-right white nationalism are going to become a central theme of his campaign.
So I have a question, because this is something that we've been talking about here for a while. As terrible, I think, as people still are right now at calling this what it is, acknowledging how bad this is and saying the word racism, acknowledging that this is bad, we didn't start here, because as we mentioned earlier in the show, one could say that the modern conservative movement has kind of been here. And a lot of people who are never Trumpers, they love Reagan. And remember, that's the welfare queen president. And the racism has been there. It's been strong. It's been part of the trajectory that got us to Trump. So what can we do to stop it from getting worse? Even if he didn't behave, you know, as explicitly as he does, what realistically can be done?
It's unclear at this point. Uh-huh. I wrote my first thing on the internet about Steve King being a white supremacist in 2005.
Wow.
So I think up to this point, there's been quite a bit of denial. The Republicans have tried to use that canard, like, well, you can't just call everyone you disagree with a racist. But they've slowly increased their acceptance level for this kind of white nationalist rhetoric. The biggest problem that I see going into 2020, and I don't know how we fix this, is that the media doesn't seem to have learned anything in general from the 2016 election. You know, Trump kicks a ball and 100 reporters go chasing after it. Their default frame for debating racism or talking about and covering racism is simply to have people talk about whether or not what was said is racist.
Which is so offensive, yes.
It's totally counterproductive, but that's the only, rather than simply saying this is racist and then covering the substance of it, you have to split the screen in half, bring on one person from the right, bring on one person from the left, and then talk about, was this racist? You know, and that's so counterproductive. And the intent of that is just to let the viewer, you know, essentially say, you decide. If you want to consider this racist, you can, but we're not going to tell you that it is. They're just so afraid to say it.
Ed, you brought up the potential distraction because people bring it up a lot when they talk about things that the president does. So to what degree, because this is always one of the debates too, to what degree do you think this is a strategy for getting reelected, because he kind of stumbled into that because he can't help but to spew his racist nonsense. Then once he said it, he has to go with it as a strategy to go against these four congresswomen. Or how much is it to try to distract from things like his lawlessness, the upcoming thing that happened today with Robert Mueller testifying? Where do you think it lands with what he's trying to do?
You know, this is a big debate. A lot of the people I know who are in political science, we fall on two sides. One is that Donald Trump is an idiot savant who secretly has a brilliant strategy. The other is that there's no strategy at all. And I tend to fall into the second camp. I think this is what he does simply because this is who he is, and he doesn't know any other way to do this. I don't believe that there's a 12th level chess strategy behind what he's doing. I believe that this fundamentally reflects his worldview, which is white nationalist and xenophobic and racist in you know, to its core. And this is simply him being the only way he knows how to be. So as far as him planning this as a way to you know, game his odds in 2020, I think that regardless of what was going on around him, this is the kind of rhetoric we're going to get from him because this is who he is.
And Ed, I know we have to wrap, but I just wanted to know really quick, what was the reaction to your piece back in 2005 about Steve King? You're very, it sounds honest.
Well, I wasn't big potatoes back then, so I don't think many people noticed it, but I've always, I feel the best way to deal with this sort of thing is to call it what it is. And there's been a long battle for the Republican Party to deny calling it what it is. And now we see the results of that.
All right, Ed, thank you so much for being here. Ed Bermilla, host of the podcast, the Masks for Shut-Ins podcast. And you have a pretty great Twitter handle, too. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll be right back. Hey there, welcome back. An 18-year-old US citizen is back home with his family this morning after being detained, wrongfully detained, in immigration custody, forget this, more than 3 weeks. His name is Francisco Irwin Galicia. And he was held so long without being able to contact his family that his family actually worried that he had been deported. Here's how it all started, all right? Because he was detained at a CPB checkpoint. A Border Patrol checkpoint in Texas. This is what happened, all right? Galicia was actually traveling with his 17-year-old brother, Marlon Galicia, and a group of friends from Edinburg, Texas, where they live. They were going to Ranger College in North Texas for a soccer scouting event. That's when they say they came upon a CPB checkpoint. And, you know, it's important to note that at this checkpoint, this kid is an American citizen. He's a kid, he's 18, yeah. He's a teen. So legally he's an adult, but we know he's a kid. And he had never been pressed to provide travel documents. So this time was different. His brother Marlon says he only had a school ID. So Marlon only had a school ID. His brother was carrying only his Texas ID, but it's important to note that you can only get a Texas ID with a social security number, which would say that you are an American citizen, right?
You would think also without the social security number that the Texas ID is something that would be accepted by the state we call Texas.
Mm-hmm. So after 2 days of both of them in detention, Marlon, who is actually younger than Francisco, Marlon signed a voluntary deportation form. And this is really one of the saddest parts of the story to me. So he says that, I wanna go back though actually because the two say they were still at this point when they were detained, they were confident they were going to be able to pass through the checkpoint. Mm-hmm. Confident they were going to be able to pass through the checkpoint. They say we were doing something good for our futures. I didn't imagine this could happen. And now I'm so sad that I'm not with my family. This is what Marlon said from Mexico, where he is now staying with his grandmother. He says he signed that voluntary deportation order because I wanted to talk with my mom. Now we just have to wait and see and hope that they release my brother. Now, this interview happened before, right before his brother was released. Let's get back to the story. So their mother says Francisco was actually not allowed to use the phone in custody for 3 weeks, but he was finally able to call her collect right before he was released. So the mother also says, I presented them with his original birth certificate and other documents and they ignored them. So now I faxed over all the documents to the ICE agent handling the case. She said he's going on a full month of being wrongfully detained. He's a US citizen and needs to be released now. Just a day after the Dallas Morning News reported the story, he was released. After the story went national, after the story went viral, this American citizen who shouldn't have been detained at all was released. His little brother, this family is broken apart. Not only does he have the trauma of basically being in jail for 3 weeks, but his little brother is now in a country that he doesn't really know.
Imagine, first of all, we're going to talk about following the rules and stuff. This was an immigration checkpoint. Mm-hmm. Similar to maybe there's a sobriety checkpoint on a Saturday night in a busy area because they know people drink and drive. Mm-hmm. There's a reason they have these things to make sure they collect people that are potentially breaking the law and they can potentially harm other people in doing so. So imagine you hit to that checkpoint. They give you the eye test. They ask you, have you been drinking tonight? And you go, no, officer, I haven't. And they make you blow into a breathalyzer. What if they make you do everything to prove that you're telling the truth? Then after you blow a 0.00 in that breathalyzer, they go, you know what? Let's throw an ethnicity out there that people assume, used to assume are just drunks. Mm-hmm. I think Irish, did they assume that about Irish folks before back in the day?
Maybe.
Drunks. Oh, they assume about Native Americans.
Yeah, okay.
Native Americans as well, too. They're drunks.
Okay.
So imagine they go, yeah, you know what? You blew that 0.00, but you know what? The way you look tells me that you must be lying. This indication, this proof of your innocence must be false because of what's on your face, mm-hmm. what's on your body, who you are and where you came from. Imagine that and then see if you still support things like this. Because this is exactly what happened. They gave the exact things and imagine being held for 3 weeks after that and not being able to even make a call to your family.
Right, so after almost a month in custody, his mother says an ICE official called her around 2 p.m. and told her that they had found his documents and citizenship to be valid and that he had been freed. And she says the first thing he said to me was, mommy, they let me go, I'm free. That just, I think, puts it in perspective how young these people are who were treated like this. And again, he's going home and his little brother is not there. His little brother has been deported to Mexico. And just in case that's confusing, his mother had him in America and then moved back to Mexico while pregnant about a year when he was a year and a half old, mm-hmm. and had his little brother and then realized that where she was living was not safe and she couldn't live there. And I think that also proves the point that these people don't just want to come to America because America, they don't want to leave their homes. They have to, they want to go back to their homes. They want their homes to be safe. And so she ended up then coming back here and raising both boys here. I think it's important to note that this is not the first time this has happened, and unfortunately, it's not at all going to be the last time this has happened. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents repeatedly target US citizens for deportation by mistake, making wrongful arrests based on incomplete government records, bad data, lax investigations, and this is all according to a Times review of federal lawsuits, internal ICE documents, and interviews. And since 2002, ICE has released from its custody more than 1,400 people. And after investigating their citizenship claim, just to talk to you about one of the more egregious ones, a New York resident, okay, was locked up for more than 3 years. A New York resident, an American citizen, was locked up for more than 3 years fighting deportation efforts after a federal agent mistook his father for someone who wasn't a US citizen. 3 years.
I don't know how these things continue to happen. Actually, I do.
Right.
I know how.
You do.
Because there's no deterrence for these types of crimes. Let's keep them calling what it is. Just because you're law enforcement doesn't mean that you're not committing crimes. That's one of the misconceptions we have about law enforcement. Yeah, they can break the law because they have to operate within it. But we don't We don't really care about that because we want to go after the people that we deem are scary. So you know, they talk about criminals. We need deterrence to make sure they don't do things. That's why people love the death penalty. It's going to make other people not do it. What is keeping these guys from doing this over and over and over again? As you said, it's happened before and it's going to happen again because they're not held accountable when they do it. And the people above them cover for them and make sure that they can have the opportunity to do it again.
And when it comes down to it, it matches back up with the president saying people who essentially are not white, they're un-American. People also who are not white may at some point have to prove that they are from this country, because we talk about Latin Americans and people who are Mexican. This was a black man.
Every time it's something else, they don't, as long as he looks different.
Yeah. All right, so we've had fun filling in for John today.
This is good.
Yeah, this is good. This is a good show. He'll be back tomorrow. And thanks for hanging out with us. I'm Brooke Thomas. This is JR Jackson. JR Wednesdays. Thanks for watching.
Always good times.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.